You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Hello, Alan. How are we doing today?
Hey, Casper. Hey, Christina. We're doing well. Yes, yes. Still here.
Alan's got a funky new haircut for all you listeners at home. But we have to keep you informed because obviously you care.
Absolutely. Yes, yes. Face for radio. That's what I've been told.
So. So what have we got on the agenda for Dear Science today?
Well, today we're going to talk about composting, of all things, kicking off with that. And for those of you who do such a thing, and according to some studies, about sort of 10% of people do this regularly, home compostable plastics. These are supposedly plastics that you can stick in your compost and they will be chewed up by the bugs and turned into good, yummy stuff to grow your veggies and stuff like that in the future. However, there has been a study of this by workers at University College London in the UK, and they have some bad news to report, unfortunately. That pretty much 60% of the plastics that are said to be home compostable are not.
I can't say I'm that surprised, though, because when you said compostable plastics, I think I'm quite cynical. So my first thought is that this cannot be real.
Well, there's no reason why it can't be real. You know, there are bugs that do pretty much anything. You can get bugs that sort of eat gold and, you know, stuff like that. So... and there's certainly bugs that eat plastic, but the question then comes, how do these things get designated as being home compostable, is the question. And so seemingly the way that it works is that, you know, you do laboratory studies on these things, you use probably one type of bug, very, very carefully controlled conditions, and you find that the bug eats up the plastic, etc., etc.
But home composts could have quite different conditions.
And you've got it in one. Right. So that seems to be the problem. So what these workers did was that they did a citizen science project. So they called for volunteers who were composters to sort of try this out for a length of time. And they ended up with 1,648 citizen scientists who were keen on this. They weren't quite so keen at the end of it because only 902 of them got to the end. But, you know, still that's a decent number. And so what is required for something to be called home compostable is that 90% of it must have disappeared within 6 months of being placed in the compost heap. Okay, so that's sort of your baseline. And, they were finding certainly that, you know, when they did go through their compost heap that, you know, they're getting large amounts of material that hadn't been touched. And, you know, as I said, around about 60% pretty much had not performed up to specifications. So we obviously have a problem here. You know, what are we going to do about this? So the problem, as you said, Casper, obviously is that, you know, the laboratory tests are carried out under stringent conditions, whereas home composters are using a whole heap of different conditions. You know, some people have, you know, the dedicated big, you know, bin and stuff like that, and they, you know, mix it every day or whatever it is that you're meant to do, or some people just chuck it on a heap or whatever. So you've got all of these different conditions, and it's no wonder that, you know, things are not working as they should do. And what has been suggested as a possible fix for this, if there is one, is that it should all be sent to industrial composters who know what they're doing, more so possibly than sort of your mum's and dad type sort of backyard operation.
But then surely you have all of the problems of transporting and all of these things that increase the sort of emissions and the footprint
really
of the things involved.
Really just cancel out the benefits, wouldn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Mm. So... what are we going to do about this? Well, there's one organic company in the UK who, as a result of this, they've now stopped employing compostable plastic, and they've just gone back essentially to paper packaging where at all possible. Mm. You know, this is a chemistry question, ultimately. And, you know, there are materials out there that you can compost, you know, that will biodegrade. And the difference between biodegradation and composting is a matter of time. So biodegradation, there's no time frame based on that. You just basically say that, you know, you leave it out long enough and it'll eventually degrade. Whereas composting is a definite thing. It's like, you know, sort of within a year or two sort of thing. So, you know, this isn't good. And apparently New Zealand doesn't have a sort of set of standards as to what constitutes compostable or home compostable, which... would surely be a start, and I guess it's a matter of caveat emptor, I suppose. Buyer beware out there. If you do see something labelled, home compostable, I guess ask about it. You know, how has this been designated? You know, who did the tests on this? How were they done? Etc. etc. You know, can I really expect that this is going to work? Because, you know, really, it'd be great if it did, because you know, we are stuck with plastics. There's no viable, at the moment anyway, alternative to plastics. So the world is pretty much stuck with it. We've got to be able to handle them better. We've got to be able to recycle them or do whatever with them, but we can't just keep chucking them in the bloody sea, because, you know, that's you know, it's not working. So
it does seem to be, yeah, kind of a policy problem as well, because you don't have those widespread regulations that,
yeah,
you know, show people how to compost properly.
Yep.
So you've got the technology there, but it's just kind of a waste if people can't utilise it.
No pun intended. Oh, ka-ching.
It's too early for this, Alan. God.
And only 10% of people composting.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I assume quite a few of those people maybe are more conscious already of their consumption and what kind of packaging they're using.
Yeah.
What about all of these people who don't have access? I mean, I personally don't have access to the ability to compost because I live in the city and don't have the space and that kind of thing.
Well, which is supposedly why the council then does sort of green waste and stuff like that, and presumably that all goes to industrial composters. And, you know, that may be the best place for it. I don't know. But, you know, unless you're a really, you know, Intuit gardener or whatever who wants to make their own mulch and et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, we've got to do something. Got to do something. So there you go, folks out there. If you've got any ideas as to what to do with plastics, we're all ears.
Switching tacks here, we've got our second topic, which is completely different, actually.
It
this is something about music and the kinds of frequencies that kind of get people out on the dance floor in greater with greater enthusiasm, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Tell us about this.
And you two young things strike me as clubbers, probably. I'm sure you're well sort of versed in...
Definitely not when we're getting up at 6 a.m. to do the news.
But, Alan, I thought you were also a bit of a clubber yourself.
Oh, no, not me. Not me. No. But anyway, the science of very low frequencies, or VLFs. And very interesting, this. Very interesting. I didn't know much about this. Well, I didn't know anything about it until I read it. So a bunch of neuroscientists in Canada are interested in very low frequencies. And by very low frequencies, we're talking anywhere from 8 hertz to 37 hertz. Now, I have come prepared today because I have a tone generator on my iPhone. I'm going to play you 37 hertz, see if you can hear it. I'm going to rack this right up as loud as it can go.
A real professional science demonstration.
Oh, hey, no, but you've got to listen really carefully, because unless you've got great ears. Here we go. That is 37 hertz, folks.
Oh.
So you can just, well, I can just hear it.
Barely
noticeable.
And
I've got old ears, you know. So so that's the upper end of the frequency range that they're looking at. So 8 hertz to 37 hertz.
So it's even lower than that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. Way, 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 way lower. So 8 hertz, you know. So, and they want to know, you know, does this have an effect on people? If you can't hear something, does it affect you? So what they did was they got a whole lot of folks at this electronic gig by a band called Ofix or something. It looked like it was missing a vowel there, I think. I'd never heard of them. They're from Canada.
That's how you know it's genuine electronic music.
That's legitimate.
Yes.
Yeah.
And what they did was they got them wearing motion capture headgear, okay? And so they could figure out, you know, how they were bopping and where they were bopping and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what they did, so this was a 50-minute set, and they were turning the very low frequency on and off during this set, And then they were monitoring the movements of these folks during the time, obviously, when the frequencies were on and when they were off. And then at the end of that, what they then did was they asked a few of the people to actually listen to the concert, just you know, with their ears, and see if they could hear when the very low frequencies are on or off.
Mm.
And they couldn't. Okay. So they couldn't hear whether they're on or off. So therefore, any impact that it made on their dancing or movements or whatever must be through some other means. If they're not, if it's not audible, then, you know,
I'm curious about this motion capture technology. I wonder if people dance more or dance differently if they've got this sort of rig on them testing their
skills. Well, that was the thing. They said that, you know, when the VLF was on, they saw an 11.8% increase in what do they call it? Motion and exaggerated movements.
Compared to when wasn't playing.
Yeah, compared to when it
and
wasn't
obviously
playing.
Obviously you couldn't hear it either, so they've I don't know, felt it? Or?
Well, that's the thing. Apparently, you know, well, I'm, as you know, anybody who's been to a gig knows that you can actually feel the sound, can't you?
Yep.
And so there are apparently sensors on the skin that can get this, and there's sensors inside your body that can get this as well. And so it must be through that these responses then come. It doesn't appear to be auditory. And certainly, you know, as you saw before, you can just barely hear 37 hertz. So you haven't got a hope in hell of hearing 8 hertz. So I think that's kind of cool. So they've come up with these results, basically saying, yep, here are the data. We figure that people are certainly moving more when the very low frequencies are on. Next step, obviously, they want to then study the brains of these people at the time that they're doing this sort of stuff. So, you know, what effect is this having on the brain? So, you know, I think it's kind of cool.
So we're moving beyond the sonically damaging loud music, and now you can just go to a gig and listen to a nice low hum. Very chill and relaxed.
The 8 hertz music. I think there's a new industry on the way. Alan's pioneering this new movement in music.
Very interesting.
Speaking
stuff.
Of new technologies.
Ooh. are we? Oh, we are. Absolutely, we are. Yes. So today, 8th of November. 8th of November, big day in the history of science, because this guy by the name of Wilhelm Röntgen in 1895 went to work one day on the 8th of November, and he changed the world. And he changed the world for everybody probably who is listening right now, because everybody in the world will have had one. Well, not everyone in the world, but everybody listening will have had one of these, I'm sure. An X-ray. And what I'd sort of like to do is to try and just sort of imagine what an enormous deal this must have been in 1895. We take them for granted now, obviously, you know, as I say, everyone's had one. But in 1895, this is absolutely unprecedented. And so he goes to work one day and he's playing around with cathode ray tubes. Now, those of you of a certain age, not you two, will remember old colour TVs. They used to be about yay thick, you know, none of these things you can hang on the wall or any of that, you know. And they were called cathode ray televisions, okay, because they were beams of electrons and they were shooting out, giving you different colours, blah, 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 blah. And he's playing around with one of those. A very antiquated version of it, and he'd covered it up with a cardboard tube, and he found that the rays were coming through this cardboard tube somehow, and they were flashing on a fluorescent screen. And so he thought, oh, that's interesting. And they were X-rays. And within a month, he'd basically figured out that, yep, these X-rays are pretty remarkable things. They can go through matter. And we can make photographic images from them. And the first medical X-ray was his wife's hand. It's a very, very famous picture. If you Google that, you will see it. It has her wedding ring on her hand, and all the bones and everything. And, you know, think about that. And Christina's just pulled it up right there. And it's, you know, that's utterly astonishing. You know, one day you go to work and now you've invented something that can see through people, for goodness sake. You know, that's amazing. And so obviously X-rays have been really, really important over the 120 odd years since they were discovered on this day way back in the day. And Röntgen got a Nobel Prize for this. In fact, he was the first person to win the Nobel Prize in physics. This was the inaugural Nobel Prize in physics in 1901, and he won for X-rays.
Well deserved.
Oh, hell yeah. But there's always a but, isn't there? There's always a but. they didn't know that X-rays were kind of bad for you. They had to figure that out. Same as with radioactivity, same sort of thing. You know, they didn't know that radioactivity was bad, and poor old Marie Curie died because of that. Mm. Roentgen was lucky, seemingly, but a lot of people weren't. And one of the most horrifying things that they used to do was to have shoe-fitting fluoroscopes in shoe stores. And these were X-ray machines in which your kids would put their feet.
Aww.
And they would wiggle their so these were live X-rays, basically, and you could see your toes wiggling.
It sounds really cool, but
a
big uptick in foot cancer, I assume.
Yeah, and so this started in about 1920, and it was to see whether the shoes were fitting properly.
That's insane. Okay. Yeah.
And these were still in the States in 1970s, apparently. The last recorded one was in the States in the 1970s, and it was only around about the 1950s that they figured out, oh yeah, maybe not. Maybe these aren't particularly good for you. And the one other thing, now this is what the internet was invented for. There was a story that somebody in 1913 had taken an X-ray of a boiled egg in somebody's stomach being attacked by all of the digestive juices and stuff like that. So they actually made an X-ray movie by taking one shot every 4 seconds or something like that, piece it together as a movie, and there's this egg being attacked by all of your good old stuff.
That sounds like a
horror movie. Now, I want to see this, but it's not. Well, I can't find it on the internet anywhere, unfortunately. But that's the sort of thing that the internet's made for, is a movie of an egg digesting in the stomach. You know, I think that's awesome.
Well, if anyone has access, let us know. We'll send it through to Alan, and he can live out his dreams.
Directly email that one through to him.
Yeah, indeed.
He's quite desperate. I'll leave you with this image because I find it hilarious. I don't know if you've ever seen a baby being X-rayed, but it's quite funny because they have to be put in a tube so that they can stay still.
Yeah, keep them still. Yep.
And it's like a...
No, that's not so real.
An image-based wire show for today.
So I do implore you to go on and search up baby X-ray tube, and we'll leave you with that image. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, Alan. Oh, thank you, Motat.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.